And this is Occupied Territory with Mike Fader. We're on every Thursday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. And, of course, the show is available on podcast, reminding you that we have a Facebook page for Occupied Territory. And I encourage everybody, new listeners, old listeners, to go there and post your comments, any videos, anything that you, if you've been to an action, if you've been to an event, post photos, anything you want. And it's just Google Occupied Territory and Facebook, Occupied Territory and Facebook, and it'll take you to the page. You can become a friend of the page, even a good buddy, anything you want to call yourself, just make it over to that page. We have a couple of guests today, and we have some information, I think, that's interesting. Our first guest is Kevin Gastola. Hi, Kevin.
Hey.
Kevin, let me tell the listeners a little bit about Kevin here. Kevin is a writer for The Dissenter at FireDogLake.com, and he covers WikiLeaks, Bradley Manning, transparency issues, whistleblowing, and other various civil liberty issues. He's been one of the few reporters to be credentialed to cover the Manning proceedings at Fort Meade, and he is the co-author of the recently published book. He has a new book out, Truth and Consequences, the U.S. versus Bradley Manning, which he co-wrote with Greg Mitchell of The Nation. And there has just been another week of hearings, but I wanted to ask you a couple of questions before we get up to date on the hearings. Would that be all right?
That's fine.
Okay. Now, one of the assumptions is, I mean, I haven't read your book, right? I've read parts of it here and there, and I've talked to you before, and I've read articles you've written. But the interesting thing about, I'm interviewing whistleblowers all the time on this show. I'm going to have Sybil Edmund on next week, you know, about the FBI. But but a lot of whistleblowers are not shy, to say the least, or at least they come forward, even if it's hard, to tell their story. They admit they did this. They did it for honorable reasons. They did it for reasons that they felt it was their patriotic duty to tell us what was going on. But the Bradley Manning case is a little exceptional because he has not announced to the world that, yes, I leaked all these files, right?
That's correct.
So is the assumption in your book, I mean, it's a funny thing to say, but is the assumption in your book when you write about all the effects that these leaked files might have had, is it a theoretical assumption, or are you assuming as an author or as a reporter that he did it?
Based on the evidence that I've seen in legal proceedings, I tend to think that he did do it. I also lean towards the camp of people that think if he did commit it, I'm not interested in talking about him as a criminal, but rather thinking that it's to his credit that he would have released the information. Because as a journalist, I've benefited. I've been able to write countless stories because I've seen documents that the government would never release.
Mm-hmm. So it's an odd circumstance, though, that people are writing books about him and articles about him, and your new book is out now. Again, it's called Truth and Consequences, the U.S. versus Bradley Manning. It's interesting, though, that all these things are being said about him and written about him based on an assumption that he's a hero and that he's done this and he's benefited us tremendously for the principle and the actuality of what he did. And yet he's having a trial right now to prove whether or not he did it.
Yeah, I mean, what you say is true, that a lot of whistleblowers come forward and they talk about it openly, and that's because they believe in the system, and the system was flawed, or it made missteps, and they experienced it firsthand, like, for instance, Thomas Drake, the NSA whistleblower, mm-hmm. and so he tried to inform, and so you try to inform and you try to make some kind of a change, and when people within departments don't respond to you, then you go outside because you figure you have absolutely no choice. And to a certain extent, Bradley Manning actually did do that because there is an anecdote, a story of him going to a commander and complaining about the fact that he was going to be helping the military capture detainees in Iraq that were going to eventually be tortured over some books that had been written, over some materials that the military had found. And then he didn't really want to feed into this. And mm-hmm. so he complained, and the commander basically thought his concerns were invalid or unreasonable, and so Bradley goes back to the skiff, and you know, in the aftermath, you see him start to engage in more actions. And I don't know if there's a connection necessarily, but it all feeds into feeling like, hey, I'm gonna take these documents and hand them over to this WikiLeaks organization that I've read about.
Now, again, we'll just touch on this one more time, and then move on to larger, more important issues, like you know, what's the way he's being treated, and what the results are, maybe, of what he leaked. But one last legality is, he's got lawyers representing him in court. There are charges preferred against him, and we'll discuss that. Is he calling witnesses? Are his defense lawyers calling witnesses in any way to deny that he actually leaked his documents? Are they calling witnesses to rebut the specific charges against him? How's that working?
Well, so far it's been very difficult for the defense to make a case and call witnesses. In the first proceeding that took place in December, I witnessed many witnesses be denied, and I saw his lawyer, David Coombs, try to get witnesses into the proceedings so that they could help him make a case that would help him defend Manning. But the presiding officer didn't allow these people to give testimony.
And the reason for that was what?
Basically making a blanket assumption that what they had to share would be irrelevant.
Oh, I see. Well, maybe they're afraid that somebody's going to come in there and make a speech or say something passionate about what he did, right?
Yeah. I mean, so the thing was that you had two individuals. You basically had only two witnesses come up against a government that had about 20 or so witnesses in this hearing, which was very significant, called the Article 32. This was when all the charges were on the table and being debated and whether they should be dropped or not, and then eventually would be referred to a military authority. And this was, you know, it's going to go on to a court-martial full process, and that's where we're at now. We're in the court-martial process fully. But this was the time when Coombs could really get some charges dropped, and he was not afforded the chance to have witnesses come up and help him make that case. There was a lot of pushback.
Now, this week, what transpired during the course of this past week?
Well, so this week was significant because, and it typically happens in court martials, but we had Coombs arguing that all the charges needed to be dismissed that have prejudice. And this was based on the fact that he had looked closely at the way that the government was handling his requests for evidence that he needs to make a case. And they had made this really improper assumption, or they had made this conclusion that he did not deserve to get classified information under standard military discovery rules. And so he looked at all of the rules, and it agreed that, like, this is information you're supposed to be able to have to make your case. And so he figured out and called them out on it that they were carrying this out improperly. And he said, look, you spent 2 years not giving me evidence that I need, and if now you're going to go back and do it correctly, well, that would mean we might have to wait 2 more years for you to pull out all the evidence. And, of course, if we're thinking about a speedy trial, Riley Manning shouldn't have to wait 2 more years for an actual trial because the government screwed up looking for evidence. Mm-hmm. So his theory was that all the charges should be dismissed that have been prejudiced by the fact that you failed to produce evidence.
Right.
And, of course, as is probably to be expected, the judge, whose name is Denise Lind, she decided that he didn't have any evidence of prosecutorial misconduct, and this motion was just denied.
So this is a colonel in the Army, right?
She's a military judge.
All right. This happens sometimes in cases with other whistleblowers because the Obama administration has a horrible record when it comes to going after whistleblowers and the way they try to get away with things in court. And in some federal circuits, even to the level of appeals courts with whistleblowers, they've been going after people, dragging people into court, you know, preferring charges against them, arguing against them, and then not producing evidence that would prove their case and going to the judge and saying, you know, it's top secret. We can't share it with anybody, even you. And the judges are allowing this. So, you know, in most cases, I spoke to somebody from the Brennan Center the other night on one of my other shows, and she said this is unheard of, basically, in any kind of federal court, let alone almost any other American court. When you are charged with a crime by the authorities, they have an absolute duty under the law to produce the evidence that supports their charge, or else the case gets thrown out. So this is extraordinary, right? I mean, is it so different under military law?
Well, what's interesting to me is to sit there as a passing observer who hasn't followed military justice proceedings. I mean, I must admit that this is the first military justice case that I've closely followed. And what's interesting is to hear Coombs, his lawyer, saying that the military has this culture where they allow for much more discovery. And when you think about it, that might seem true, because it's my understanding, or it's sort of my sense, that a lot of people who get accused of crimes in the military have a pretty easy time trying to get off. I mean, you don't hear about a lot of these more egregious cases where they actually do end up going to jail for long periods of time. Mm-hmm. I mean, so it would seem like they do give people a lot of latitude to get off, except not in this case. I mean, I would say that you could compare it to maybe the Frank Wirich, who was accused of being involved in the Haditha massacre, and say that, you know, perhaps he had more ability to get information out of the government to prove his case, but maybe Manning, because of what he did, because of the nature of the leaks and how upsetting it is to government officials, that he's being obstructed, because it's a whole different thing. I mean, mm-hmm. I'm just basically making the general point that I think killing people actually doesn't have that much of a doesn't pose that much of a problem to the powerful, but what Bradley allegedly did is much more problematic.
What is it that the charges, what are the exact charges against him?
So the exact charges basically break down into one federal offense, which is the aiding the enemy charge, which we should get into more, because that was a big thing this week, but I'll continue through here and say the other charges have to do with bringing discredit to the military. And there's, I think there's more than 10 charges that have to do with bringing discredit. And then there's a few charges that are related to unauthorized downloading of software to his computer, and so those are the sets of charges.
So he's not charged. I mean, the closest he's not literally charged with treason. The closest you get to that is aiding. Providing aid and comfort to the enemy. I mean, how do they figure? What is their argument? Although I guess they haven't really made it yet. But how did they, what is their point of view that he aided the enemy? How did he aid the enemy?
Well, it's interesting, because this week, what was great about the hearings is that we did get to see an argument laid out by the government. I got some great insight into exactly what the government is thinking and why they're going to hang him. But just quickly, just for your listeners, mm-hmm. he's charged under something called Article 104, and basically the exact thing that it reads is that without proper authority, he knowingly harbors or protects or gives intelligence to or communicates or corresponds with or holds any intercourse with the enemy, either directly or indirectly.
Oh, indirectly.
And this is, mm-hmm. yeah, so he's charged with indirectly. They say that he knowingly provided intelligence to WikiLeaks that, you know, would indirectly aid the enemy, basically. And, you know, the problem here is that it doesn't show in what he did any actual evil intent. I mean, it's not like Coombs gave a good example that sort of separates what really happened between what, you know, typically you might see this charge handed down for. So he said, like, for example, if you sent a package with FedEx, mm-hmm. and you sent intelligence in a FedEx box to the enemy, and you had the address on it, mm-hmm. well, then that would indicate that you were doing something evil. You wanted to pass along documents.
Well, and the intention is clear.
Yeah. Yeah. And he used FedEx as a third party, sort of how they're accusing WikiLeaks of being a third party.
Oh, I see.
But this is not what happened. He was not using WikiLeaks to get to Al-Qaeda. At least in my reporting so far, I've seen no evidence that he could have just passed the information on to someone in Al-Qaeda if he wanted to be aiding terrorism. There's no reason why he would need to announce this information to terrorists through WikiLeaks.
But they don't really care about his intentions, according to the law. I mean, if he indirectly, even without intent, aided them, he's aiding them, right?
Correct. So in their argument, they actually wrote the charge so that they would not have to prosecute him, and in order to succeed, they would have to prove intent. So they have no responsibility to prove intent, which is what the government lawyers have actually raised. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the big issue here is that all they have to prove, and so Coombs tried to get this charge dropped and thrown out because it's quite a significant charge. The ACLU has suggested that it could even be used to stifle free speech in the military the way that they are interpreting it.
What is the prescribed punishment if you're convicted of this?
You can suffer death or most likely you would get life without parole. It is a capital offense.
And so did they proceed ahead with this charge? They didn't drop this charge this week, right?
Right. The charge was not dropped, and it still sticks. But essentially, now the judge has put a burden on the government, and they have to prove that Bradley Manning knew by giving information to WikiLeaks that he would in fact be aiding the enemy. And now I've seen the evidence that the government has presented, and I don't know if this is the limit of what they have. They claim to have something. They claim to know that Bradley knew Al-Qaeda frequently visited WikiLeaks. And so would have been aiding this group.
Mm-hmm.
But I think all they have, I've seen it, he was punished because he put some photos of himself on his Facebook page when he was in the military, and he had used language and videos that you're not supposed to use that sort of broke information security rules that the military has, and he was punished and made to produce a PowerPoint presentation on information security, and one of the things he did list was that WikiLeaks was a site that the enemy could go to for information. So that's
all
they might have to work off of.
Well, I mean, they could also order flowers on flowers.com, right? I mean, well, in any case. Let me ask you a question, and then we'll get back a little bit to what's going on right now, and then what might happen, or what the next step is, practically speaking. But just working on the assumption that he did it, or even without that assumption, that we do know that all these documents were leaked and they were classified. I don't know what level they were at. They were State Department cables. They were other cables. He got them in his capacity working in the Army. He released maybe some video and a whole lot of documents. And has the effect on the world or on the Army or on the United States or its safety been disastrous? I mean, what are the effects of these documents in terms of how the enemy has profited by them?
Truthfully, there isn't really any harm. Nobody can point to any impact from it that has made it impossible for the U.S. military or government to engage in the regular operations that they do day to day. I mean, it hasn't impacted the ability of the military to continue, you know, their war in Afghanistan. They haven't had a problem with launching strikes in the various countries where, you know, drones are dropping bombs now. And as far as diplomacy goes, it appears that the State Department is still able to meet with people and have the same closed-door meetings that they regularly have. And, you know, Robert Gates knew that the United States is a superpower, and so, you know, as much as countries would see this information and might be upset, they would eventually come back around to working with the United States because they have no choice. I mean, they mm-hmm. have to work with the superpower.
Well, what if I was to say that it sets an example? It's not just him, but anybody who desires to leak classified documents. I mean, it's a bad example if you allow somebody, if you don't convict somebody who has leaked hundreds of thousands of documents. What's the point of even having secret documents or classified documents? I mean, should government be conducted entirely in the open? You know, to be the devil's advocate a little bit, you know.
I mean, that's exactly right. They have to make an example out of him, because if they don't, I mean, if they actually were to admit that he didn't cause harm, and they sort of have, actually. I mean, that's a larger issue, but to answer your question, mm-hmm. I mean, if they admit that he didn't really do anything that was wrong, then they put themselves in this position where in the future, if you are a member of the military, you might think about releasing material. And, you know, so far, just for example, I mean, we had the LA Times publishing a couple photos of soldiers holding mangled corpses of suicide bombers in Afghanistan. And there was such a storm of people just saying, how dare you actually show what soldiers do in war and bring it home to people here, and what's the point? And so, I mean, the issue is that the military does have to control all the information that we get so that it can carry out its war efforts. And so they do have to prosecute Bradley Manning to the fullest extent.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, this is sort of a segue into what you're talking about now, is this, to me, absurd and embarrassingly ridiculous charge of bringing discredit to the military. I mean, the only people who are bringing discredit to the military are the military, right? I mean, he's actually, as far as I'm concerned, a credit to the military, because in the sense that you don't carry out, like, for instance, Lieutenant Calley, you know, in My Lai in Vietnam, or anywhere, if somebody gives you an order, and this is in the military code of conduct, if somebody gives you a direct order that you consider to be immoral or illegal in every possible way, you have a right to refuse it, right? I think the opposite is true. You probably should have a duty. If somebody is doing something outrageous and somebody is committing murder all over the world and somebody is tearing up our Constitution, you have almost like a right or a duty, if you're a soldier or even if you're a citizen, to reveal it, I think.
I mean, I would agree. I mean, I guess you could add to that, a less radical example, someone who's actually managed to keep his position in the military. But if you were to add into the mix Lieutenant Colonel Davis, who released the report about Afghanistan showing how the reality on the ground wasn't the same as what the military was telling people here at home, and how it didn't match up and was bringing great negative impact to the soldiers in Afghanistan, and so you want those people who are in the military to speak out and bring the reality here, because otherwise you lose lives, people get killed, and you also allow massacres and other war crimes to go unpunished.
So we only have a couple of minutes, and you're listening to Kevin Gastola, who has got he reports for Fire Dog Lake on the Bradley Manning trial and the ordeal of Bradley Manning. But his new book is called Truth and Consequences, the U.S. versus Bradley Manning. Now, maybe you could tell people where to go online to get your updates and your writing on this and other issues.
Sure. If you go to dissenter.firedoglake.com, there's regular postings about all these issues that we're talking about here right now.
Okay.
And then, of course, the book is on Amazon if you are looking for it.
Okay, dissenter.firedoglake.com. So now, last question is, so where do we go now? Where does the trial head now?
These proceedings are headed towards a trial date that is currently set at September 21st, which is surprising because we are going to be in the middle of a presidential election. So I've heard some chatter that the prosecution isn't going to let this really happen until November. So I would just say that sometime between September and November, we actually get a trial that begins. There's more hearings like the hearings I attended. There's three more scheduled for the summertime, one in June, July, and at the end of August, and I'll be covering those as well. So the legal proceedings continue to just putter on slowly but surely, and you know, by the time he goes on trial, Bradley Manning will have been in pretrial confinement for over 800 days.
Which, of course, is a violation of his rights as an American anyhow. Not to be too cynical, but I think a lot of people assume that they will convict him. And is there a higher-level court that he can go to on appeal?
I mean, it's interesting hearing the arguments that were raised in court. I actually put out that I think this is destined to be appealed and eventually get to the Supreme Court. I mean, it seems like the way they're applying the aiding the enemy charge certainly gives his lawyers a reason to challenge it on the basis that it's being applied unconstitutionally. So I would just think that if he is convicted and does get life without parole, that's going to be appealed, and it'll continue on. So in this case, we'll probably be reporting on it into 2013.
So you're assuming, or you're maybe some of us are hoping, I mean, I wish they'd just let him out, but they're not going to, that this will make its way from the military into the federal court system, perhaps.
I just think it's such a high profile case that as you know, the notoriety that his lawyers are getting for taking this up, and sort of what he's trying to do to defend and help Manning not get stuck in jail for life without parole. I mean, he had said, you know, he didn't say that he's not guilty. He said, could you just put him in there for 35, 40 years? And they wouldn't let him, you know, go for that. And so I just think Coombs would be doing a disservice to his client if he didn't put an appeal in after the trial.
All right. Well, we'll continue to follow this. And when there's more hearings during the summer, if you have some availability, we'd like to talk to you again. All right.
Certainly. Thank you.
Okay, Kevin Gastola, and this is about Bradley Manning, and you want to get more information about this, where to go online to check for it, get updates about his book and other writings that he does. You can, sometime later this afternoon or tomorrow, you can go to our Facebook page. That's Occupied Territory on Facebook, and we'll have that information up. This is Occupied Territory with Mike Fader. I'm your host here every Thursday at between 1 and 2 p.m. Eastern. We're going to take a short break, and then we're going to come back with another guest. We are trying to get in touch with, or actually waiting for another guest who is supposed to call us, and I don't know when that call will come in, or even if. But we do hope that we get this call. And what it will be connected to, if we do get our guest, is that obviously most of the information that voters get in this country, regular middle-class voters, let's say over the age of, I don't know what, 40, and that's, you know, we're talking about tens of millions of people, still get their information from network television or cable television. And occasionally from radio. But basically network and cable television is where people, right wing, left wing, middle wing, is there a middle wing? Which is actually the vast majority of it. Corporate media, essentially. And with the occasional, you know, with the occasional place like Current TV, CurrentTV.org, you want to check online. Up until a month or two ago, they had Keith Olbermann on, who is by far the most radical and left-wing, although I hate to use these stupid labels. He was by far the most truthful and interesting and the most likely to reveal information that you would never hear anywhere else, and that includes MSNBC, which, generally speaking, is a kind of a liberal media wing of the Democratic Party, except for one or two people and parts of their shows. So we're talking about corporate media. And so with this, if we do get our next guest on, and I can tell you about his website, even if we don't get him on, it's fascinating because what they're doing is they're figuring out a way using the net, of course, inevitably, to have people chip in money in small amounts and add it up and professionally produce advertisements that will be appealing to the rest of us, to people who need more information, to people who know better what's going on and would like to follow it up, or even to people who don't know what's going on. These ads could appear on any place where if a place like Fox or MSNBC or even larger stations, if there's enough money, will allow them to. And apparently there are ways to place these ads where you don't have to have hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars. So that's what this new organization does. It's called LoudSauce. LoudSauce, LoudSauce.com. Where is it? .com? It's probably .com. Yeah, I think it's LoudSauce.com. And they are an organization which got together, I think it was last fall, and this is around Occupy, too, and did place a couple of ads. They placed ads that over 3 million viewers saw, and they only raised several thousand dollars and were able to place these ads. How they do it, I don't exactly know, but they're raising more money now to put these ads on, and we'll see how it goes. Every week I try to bring you up to date on what the 1% is doing, just so you understand where you are and who they are and what we need to do about it and what the world is like. Now, I know a lot of you just like to ignore this, right? And I can understand that because it's so tiring and despairing to see these rich people, you know, just sort of lord it over everybody and consume everything like out of a control pigs. But it happens everywhere. There was an article yesterday in the New York Times, which I cut out and I'm going to talk about some more, is a front page article about how both campaigns, the presidential campaigns, Romney and Obama, are courting Mayor Bloomberg. They're courting Mayor Bloomberg. And in the course of this article, and the New York Times sometimes is unconscious about these things because they are part of the corporate media and they are essentially very often part of the 1%. Like, for instance, you would say, although tens of thousands of people, I don't know about hundreds of thousands, but tens of thousands of people in 29, 30 different locations on May Day, demonstrated on in places. They clogged up areas where bank headquarters were. They demonstrated. There was a tremendous amalgamation of unions coming together, of workers, of just regular people, students who have been disenfranchised. There was a lot of protesting and a lot of marching in various cities, and tens of thousands of people in New York City. Not one single word in print or on network television, which is all the more reason why the net becomes more and more important all the time. And this is what goes on. So they're courting Bloomberg. You know, every time I get on the radio here or on Sirius and say that the parties are exactly the same, that the candidates are exactly the same, people point out different. They get outraged with me. They say there are vast differences between the two of them. Really? Really? Both of these guys, both Obama and Romney, have made trips to New York to have lunch or breakfast or whatever with Bloomberg. They invite him on golfing trips. They invite him to the White House. You know, they invite him on their private jets. They want to court him. They want his endorsement. And one of the things that the Times writes in their sort of semi-unconscious way is that, and they make it clear, and everybody knows this, that one reason that they're courting him, and the main reason they're courting him, is what? Not because everybody in the United States respects Bloomberg, or because anybody really likes him very much. Hardly anybody does like him in New York City, and I can tell you that. But it's because he's so rich, and because he is the funnel. He's the connection. He's the symbol of Wall Street. He's the symbol of investment banks, of hedge funds. He's it. If you want to have a direct access to them, if you want to get to know all of them, if you want to raise money from them, he's the guy you go to. He's the door that you have to walk through to walk into money land. And that's why they're going there. So please don't bother me anymore about how these two parties are so different. You have to go to great lengths and use the few details that are out there to prove, and I know what they are, Supreme Court appointments, one or two other things, that these people are any different. And I think even worse, I think Obama's even worse than Romney in some ways, because he will get up and make speeches in places where he knows he'll be warmly received by a certain group of people whose votes he needs now, and who he's generally ignored for the last few years, but now he needs their votes again. He will make speeches denouncing the rich, denouncing the way banks behave. And, of course, behind the scenes, he is kissing their ass all over the place and scooping up every last dime they drop in his, sniveling hand. And, you know, I mean, he is an utter hypocrite, this man. So in some ways, it's worse than Romney. Romney says, I'm for the rich. Screw the rest of you. I have $250 million. I'm pretty happy about it. And the rest of you can go eat, 10-day-old potatoes if you want. It's not my problem. Obama denounces people who would keep us in poverty and ship our jobs overseas and whatever else he's denouncing, whatever the pollsters tell him to denounce. And meanwhile, he is enfranchising these people. He is giving them more power than Romney ever could, because Romney doesn't even have the ability to give them the power. You know, he's the guy behind all this. So that's how it works. And Bloomberg, give me an example of Bloomberg in New York City. Bloomberg, he's done just, this is just two things in New York City that Bloomberg has done. And then there's plenty of other things too. I mean, among them, essentially, I can't say he violated the law because this is, you know, I mean, I don't want to, you know, be libelous or anything, but he essentially used a, there's a word for this, begins with a B and the second word is R. He essentially used a great amount of money or the promise of money to the city council in New York City, especially the president of the city council, Christine Quinn, to get them to overturn a vote. New York City, actually, they took a vote in New York City, and an overwhelming majority of people did not want a third term for a mayor. They wanted only two terms for some of the obvious reasons, right? You get to be like a dictator, like Giuliani. And like Bloomberg has become, he is basically, you know, Oberleutnant Bloomberg now. He is not really an elected mayor so much as he's the, I don't know what, the Pasha of New York City, and uses his cops just like a private army. Now, Bloomberg, somehow, I don't know, you could guess what it might be. Somehow he used some magic thing to convince Christine Quinn, who wants to be, that's the city council president, who wants to be mayor. He convinced her and other people in the city council. How did he do this? I don't know. I wonder how. To vote overturning the great majority of the will of New York City people, of voters in New York City, to get him to get a third term for a mayor. And then he ran for mayor on a third term, spent like $100 million. They estimate, I forget what it is, that he spent somewhere, it's either it's $25 a vote. Talk about buying votes, right? Tammany Hall, all this stuff. This man spent something like $25, and maybe as much as $100 a vote that he got. If you just, you know, divide the number into the other number of how many voters there were that voted for him and how much money he spent on the campaign. He basically bought the election after he bought the city council. This is who they're going to for his opinion and his backing and his access to all this money. And his endorsement, which he may never give. I don't really know. So this is what Bloomberg, that's one thing Bloomberg did. And way, of course, the whole world knows the way that he allows his cops to beat the living crap out of anybody who gets anywhere near where he is or anywhere near where a bank is or one of his friends is or Goldman Sachs building. I mean, the police brutality in New York City has rarely been exceeded, if not exceeded at all, by any other city in the whole Occupy movement. And that's how it is here. And typical things that that Mayor Bloomberg does in New York City to make things better for people here is that the avenues in the streets in New York City are famously crowded. I mean, the traffic jams here, I know there are traffic jams on freeways and things that you read about in Los Angeles and other places. But in Manhattan, there are gigantic traffic jams. Millions of people are here every day. Now, I don't know. I think it's like 2 million people live in Manhattan. But something like 4 million people live and work here during the course of any weekday. Millions of people come in. So the Manhattan is flooded with, you know, public transportation, buses, all kinds of, you know, garbage trucks, whatever it is, public transportation, public facilities, public agencies. Then we have tens of thousands of delivery trucks, anything from vans to gigantic, food delivery vans for supermarkets, food delivery trucks for supermarkets. Then you have millions of cars and hundreds of thousands of huge limousines, SUVs, outsized cars, right? So it's almost impossible to drive on the streets during the weekdays in New York City. And there's always traffic jams. You can hardly ever get anywhere. So what does he do with all of this? He decides, because this is the mindset he has, this is the mindset of somebody who's been so rich for so long, he doesn't know any better, and all his friends are rich, he decides to build bike lanes for bikers. In New York City, there are something, you know, like 10,000 or 20,000 bikers in New York City, people who use their bikes. He wanted people to use their bikes to get to work, and he knows that people use their bikes for pleasure, too, in New York City. Who does? So he built bike lanes. They spent tens of millions of dollars to take perfectly good, normal roads, which are already crowded, you know, arteries, main arteries in New York City. And it's already hard to drive down them and get anywhere with them with double parked cars and buses and everything. He takes 1.5 lanes, effectively, builds concrete islands down one whole side of huge traffic arteries in New York City and creates bike lanes, which nobody uses. which nobody uses. And so when you're driving a car, or you're a working person in a delivery truck, or you're a cab driver and you want to get your fare somewhere, you can't go anywhere in New York. And he created all of this for, now who uses bikes in New York City essentially, except messengers? There are bike messengers in New York City and delivery guys. Now that's good. That's good for them because they are hardworking people and they don't get paid very much. But he also created bike lanes for all the bikers in New York City because he wanted to create a kind of this beautiful, gorgeous urban environment. Only upper middle class people and a handful of them use bicycles in New York City. That didn't stop him from destroying half the traffic in Manhattan by building bike lanes. This is so typical. This is what he does. He's given franchises and licenses to all kinds of companies and businesses, media companies and businesses, big media, to put moving television advertisements and graphic advertisements on the tops of subway stations. The whole city looks like something from some science fiction movie. Blade Runner, that's the one I was searching for. The whole city is starting to look like Blade Runner, thanks to Mayor Bloomberg. Now, if you saw Blade Runner, and I advise you to go see Blade, it's a good movie anyhow. It's a wonderful movie about the future. But the future is now. The future is now. And Blade Runner is based on a novel by a wonderful science fiction writer named Philip K. Dick. And it's about what Los Angeles looks like in, I guess the time they said it was made something like 15 years ago, close to 20 years ago, the movie Blade Runner. It's set in a future which is, 40 to 60 or 100 years later. And because of pollution, the sun never comes out. There's no sun anymore. It's always raining and it's always dark and filthy everywhere, right? And people ride around the city and they walk around the city. The whole city is one gigantic advertisement. You can't ever get any sleep. You can't even look out the window. There are huge dirigibles and zeppelins floating around in the sky with huge moving advertisements on them. Everywhere you look, there are giant advertisements for Pepsi and every other product projected, massive projections against the side of buildings into your building, right? You just can't avoid the advertising in the sky. They light up the whole sky. It's like a television screen. They turn the sky into a television screen with ads all over the place. It's just basically sold the whole place, privatization, right, to put it mildly. This is what Bloomberg is doing to New York. Everywhere you go, in every public place, even if you go into a cab, you want to take a cab somewhere in New York, as soon as you go in there and they throw the meter, they start the meter, there's a television screen in the back seat, 2 inches away from your face, that you cannot get away from, that comes on, and this idiot news comes on. It's ABC News or whatever it is. People are jumping around. They're smiling, about the fact that 500,000 people died in an earthquake, whatever people do on the news. And everything is changing and flipping around, and they're making noise. And you can shut it off, but good luck. Often it breaks, and you can't shut it off. And this is all Bloomberg. Bloomberg only understands money. He only understands making money. And this is who Romney and Obama are courting, and this is where we're left. Meanwhile, here's a little note from one of my favorite websites called Too Much. Go online and Google Too Much, TOOMUCH, Too Much. And I think it's part of the Institute for Policy Studies. And you could get updates every week like this. The top new frustration facing the world's super rich? That may be, suggests the Wall Street Journal, quote, too many giant yachts and not enough places to park them. In Asia, of course, with globalization, this is a world problem. This is what's good about Occupy is that it mirrors things that are happening in other countries. Inevitably, what's happening is more and more repression, more invasion of our privacy, more removal of our civil rights, more intrusion of money into our lives, whether we like it or not. Our health is deteriorated to the point where, half of Americans are desperately ill or obese or whatever because of giant chemical companies and oil and gas companies. It's not just here. It's all over the world. They buy and sell politicians all over the world. So in Asia, Reuters reported last week, the region's nascent yachting class, its nascent yachting class, is facing trouble finding a berth in overcrowded marinas. in Barcelona, this is in Spain, where people are suffering austerity, where people are having a miserable time, right? Average, regular people. In Barcelona, a private investment fund has bought up dockside real estate in a working class neighborhood and now wants a license to build a marina big enough to handle yachts that run up to nearly 200 yards long. 200 yards long? That's 60 stories of a building. Local residents are opposing the license bid. Good luck to them, right? The proposed luxury marina, says 68-year-old pensioner Antonio Garcia, will price us out, turning the port into a place only for the very rich. Welcome to Baltimore and Boston and New York City and every other port city and every other coastal city in the United States, where developers working with their bribed and paid for lawmakers, you know, city council people, state legislators, whatever, governors, mayors, have thrown working and poor people out of their neighborhoods and torn them down with bulldozers and wrecking balls and explosives and put up gigantic, ugly condominiums for the rich so they can look out on the polluted harbor and enjoy themselves. And where do the poor people go? Mayor Koch, famously in New York City, who was a real tool of the rich. I mean, he was basically the real estate mayor, the real estate owner's mayor in New York City back in the, back in the 70s, I guess, or the 80s, whenever he was mayor. I think it was the 70s. Mayor Koch famously said, if the people don't like it here, they can move out. When people were complaining that all kinds of public eminent domain stuff was knocking down poor neighborhoods and that rents were going up and he was giving away all sorts of city property to landlords and giving breaks to landlords, it was ruining everybody's middle class life. He said, if people don't like it here, they can move. This is why there's an Occupy movement, all right? Anyhow, well, there's plenty of other stuff that we can tell you about, but we do have our guest on right now, second guest on. He's on for a couple of minutes. That's all we have time for. It's Colin Mutchler, and he's from a place called Loud Sauce. And I mentioned this before about this place. It's a platform to crowdfund ad space for ideas that matter. So, Colin, what is crowdfunding and what is Loud Sauce?
Sure. Hey, and thanks for having me on the show. So,
sure. Crowdfunding
is essentially using the internet to have small contributions, you know, collectively be able to accomplish specific projects. In the case of a site like Kickstarter, or in our case, helping to get an ad on national TV or reach millions through online video. In the case of something like Loud Sauce, so we're really just a way for people with small amounts of money to actually push ideas they care about through traditional advertising channels, which many of us discount because they're usually used by big companies and,
right,
and you know, and very wealthy people. But really, it can be used for anything. And so that's what we're trying to enable with Loud Sauce.
Now, you did have some success back in the fall, right, with an ad for something. Why don't you explain that one?
Sure. Yeah, so in back in October, a filmmaker in New York that was with the Occupy Wall Street folks made a 30-second video that was essentially an ad with voices directly from the street, posted on Loud Sauce, and people chipped in, and they're raising $6,500. And then we were able to use that money to go through Google TV ads and reach 3.2 million viewers on national TV, and even got it to air actually during the O'Reilly Factor, which was kind of crazy.
Well, how is that possible, though? I mean, I take it for granted. When I watch MSNBC or whatever, Fox, I've watched Fox about 10 minutes in my whole life, but if I watch a cable channel like that, I see ads for, you know, for GE, for cars, you know, for big companies, for Sprint, for Verizon. How could you, I mean, they're not paying what you're paying. How could you get an ad on there?
So essentially, we're using this relatively new service from Google called Google TV Ads, which essentially is auctioning spots that are still available like 2 days before. So that's why they're able to have drastically lower prices. So anybody that's, you know, using a lot of money to influence a lot of people wouldn't use that. They use traditional, you know, ways of reaching people. And you're right, GE and those guys are spending a lot more money, and they're reaching a lot more people. But I think that we discount, you know, the ability for us to still reach many people that we would not be able to reach through our traditional channels, whether it's our online communities of people that are oriented like we are, or even the media that in the independent media, which is very important, but it's difficult to actually reach beyond that and to reach people that are not paying attention to our news sources. And so using money and then through using advertising channels is actually a pretty good way of reaching that kind of audience.
So the latest fundraising is oriented towards what kind of ads? And it's happening now, right? You're looking to raise a whole lot of money from people right now for more ads. So what's your aim here?
Sure. So LoudSauce is a platform that's really open to all kinds of things, but in collaboration with Occupy.com, we are calling for people to make spots for the 99%, listening for either some of the great voices that are emerging literally in the streets, you know, over the coming, you know, on May 1st and over this coming month, or kind of, you know, translating other content that you find online that you want to comment on, but actually, literally, it's a call for entries at this point. But the intention is to raise $150,000 for a variety of spots. We've had four spots already submitted, one actually from the actor Matthew Modine, a pretty interesting spot called Somebody, and some that we're sourcing direct from General Assemblies in Los Angeles that really captured a moment. You know, those General Assemblies are really powerful, authentic moments. And if you can find those, like, 30-second gems that really hit the nail on the head and show that authentic spirit of that we were all so inspired by and continue to be inspired by, and actually just tighten it to, we're actually asking for 27 seconds so we can tack on a strong call to action and people can potentially customize it locally.
We're running out of time here because we started late. So where should people go if they want to get involved in this, which I urge everybody to do? It's a way to get your ideas across on cable channels.
Sure. So the place to submit your spots is OccupySpots.com, which will redirect to the LoudSauce platform. And we're asking people to submit 27-second spots sometime before May 21st, so in the next 3 weeks. And then on June 1st, we'll begin the fundraising. And any spot that raises more than $1,000 from the crowd will be aired on national TV at least once, hopefully a few times.
Fantastic idea. That's a great idea. Yeah.
Thanks so much for having me on the show. I know it was only a short period of time, but I think that we're really in an interesting moment where there's so much great conversation, but it's difficult to reach beyond it. And we trust, unfortunately, as everybody knows, the media does what they do, and they have their own conversation. So if we can really push using crowdfunding online to push into new conversations and new audiences, I think we can have an even bigger impact.
All right, Colin Mutchler from the LoudSauce.com. Thank you very much, and I urge everybody to go there. We'll put it on our Facebook page to direct people there. Thank you.
Thanks so much for having me, Mike. Take care.
Okay. So that's it for this week. Our last quote here is from Howard Zinn, the famous historian, the people's historian. He says, "Civil disobedience is not our problem. Our problem is civil obedience. Our problem is that numbers of people all over the world have obeyed the dictates of the leaders of their government and have gone to war. And millions have been killed because of this obedience. Our problem is that people are obedient all over the world in the face of poverty and starvation and stupidity and war and cruelty. Our problem is that people are obedient while the jails are full of petty thieves. And all the while, the grand thieves are running the country. That's our problem."